Science class, day two. I was going to thank everybody for a lot of the positive comments from yesterday's class, but on the way here I was realizing that almost all those positive comments were about the PowerPoint, and I didn't do the PowerPoint, so I'm not going to thank you. So. Yesterday we had a little analogy of a place called Flatland, a creation, and I did want to point out, and I think some people knew this, that that wasn't actually even my idea. There's a little book about that flat called Flatland, and I was kind of infatuated with that book when I was a younger person, and about a year and a half ago, I read through it again. It was written in 1884, a long time ago, and by a man named Edwin Abbott. He wrote under a pseudonym called A Square, and it was about him being a square and the sphere trying to take him out into this new dimension, and eventually got him to believe that there was this other dimension. And then when he got out there, he said, "Well, there has to be another dimension then." And the sphere said, "No." There's nothing else, and that was kind of one of my points. So if you read it, it's a kind of a geometry kind of book. There's not a whole lot of spiritualness in it, but that's one of the main points that I wanted to make, is that we don't just go into another dimension to find God. God created the universe and everything in it, and we work within that, and some of us are science people, and so therefore science works only within those confines and cannot then tell us about an absolute truth. An absolute truth is spiritually discerned through the Spirit. We can get some relative truths relative to the frame of reference that God has placed us in with science, and that's good, I think. I enjoy science. I heard a lot of people afterwards, the comments kind of always started with, "Oh, I hated science," or "I really didn't like science," or "I just wasn't good at science." And I hear that a lot from, a lot of parents will come to student, parent, teacher conferences and say, "Well, you know, I was really bad at science," you know, and I'm like, "Well, stop telling that to your kid." They just think they can use that as an excuse to be bad too. But I understand that some people don't like science as much as I do, and therefore I can be kind of annoying if I really go into some of the science fairly deep. But there are some people that like it and that enjoy hearing a lot of that, a lot of those things. So I do appreciate a lot of the respect that you showed for other people that might have liked some of the math and stuff a little bit more than maybe you did. There is a branch of science, an evolutionary branch of science, I guess I should say, that I don't really enjoy and reject, and actually am kind of offended, even as a scientist, that's how this particular branch of science came about. And we're going to talk a lot about that branch of science probably next 2 days. Today, I kind of want to start in on kind of how that came into being. I think it's really important for us to understand how certain things came into being in this world that God created for us to live in. The Greek for science is gnosis. And normally gnosis is translated to be knowledge. And I always have a lot of fun with this in my department meetings in my high school. I say, "Well, you're the art department, and you're the English department, and you're the math department, and I'm in the department of knowledge. We are the knowledge teachers." We have a lot of fun with that in the science department. And normally, any time we find gnosis in the scriptures, it's going to be translated as knowledge, and probably should all the way through, and usually referring to a spiritual type knowledge. But there is two places, and you have to go to the King James, be in the King James translation to see it, where gnosis is translated as science. And I don't have a real particular problem with that translation. In both places, I think it could be fairly valid. If we go to the two scriptures we can look at up here. The first one's in Daniel chapter 1, verse 4, which is why Daniel's one of my all-time favorite books to study and characters in the Bible, because it says in the description of him, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had the ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning in the tongue of the Chaldeans. I'm not sure that that's a terrible translation there. In science, we look to the Babylonians a lot for a lot of the early science things. And I believe that Daniel and his three friends, you know, had some abilities in these areas, and they were known for some of the things that they could do. The other one we find in 1 Timothy 6:20 through 21, I almost kind of feel is a really good translation, the way that, well, it works really well for what I want to talk about. So Rick Sparks said, we just use whatever translation sounds the best for what we're trying to talk about. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings. Avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science falsely so-called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. I think that's pretty good. There is, in my opinion, a lot of really good, interesting science. But there is one particular branch that I believe is science falsely so-called. It is not science in any way that we have ever defined science. Science or knowledge falsely so-called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. If you're going to profess this particular branch of science, you are going to err concerning the faith. You're going to have it, or you're going to have faith and in Christ. And they don't. You got to have one or the other. You can't have that branch of science and have a belief in God or Christ. They will not work together. If we look at the word gnosis, that means knowledge, I had a student this last year, and she was very, I really enjoyed her. She was very vocal about her faith and asking questions to other people and stuff. And she would always talk to, they had discussions in the back of my room, and I'd always be pretending to work, totally eavesdropping on them. And she would really ask people about what they believe and things. And she was asking, this is one of the saddest days of my life when I heard this. She was asking this other student in my class, who I enjoyed. He was a good student, and I enjoyed having him in class. But she asked him, you know, what are you? You know, that's how you get that. What are you? You ever get that question? What's your belief? That's a good question. That's not a dumb question. Do you guys know how to answer that? What are you? You know, what do you believe? You know, and it might not be good enough to just say Church of Christ. That could be a problem in today's society. That could be a problem too. What do you believe? What do you know? And it's important, I think. And that girl thought it was important to know. She knew what she felt, and she was asking other people. And she asked this boy what he believed, and he was, you could tell right away, he was uncomfortable. He was very indifferent about it, and he goes, well, my parents say that we're agnostic. That's sad. He didn't even know what it meant, but he knew that's what his parents said that they were. Agnostic. So anyway, this girl, Mr. Herman, what's agnostic? So I get in trouble a lot. And she asked me because I've had some experience outside of school speaking to a lot of the kids that are in my school, kind of have a secret religious society, and on what we have on our beliefs. And she knows where I stand and some of the disagreements I might have with her. But she appreciates that that I have a faith and what I believe in. And so she's always trying to get me in trouble and asking me questions right in class about different things. And of course, I always take the bait. So I wrote up on the board gnosis, and I wrote next to it knowledge. So that's Greek for knowledge. And whenever you put an A in front of anything, it means not or without. That's what it means. If you put an A in front of theist, theist is referring to God. You put an A in front of it, you have atheist, which means without God. is what it means. So I wrote, I put A up there on the front. I go, A always means without. I wrote without. And I just left that on the board. And then the girl, she goes, so agnostic means without knowledge? And the boy, you can see in the map, the boy was like, does that mean I'm dumb? I'm like, hey, I don't know what it means. All I'm saying is that's what the language means, and then ask your parents. I don't know. So anyway, agnostic, without knowledge, and really what it refers to is without spiritual knowledge. And this is the definition that I Googled. A person who believes that nothing is known or can be known of the existence or nature of God or of anything beyond material phenomena. A person who claims neither faith nor disbelief in God. This is just a made-up belief system here. I just might as well just say you're an atheist. In my opinion, that's what it ends up coming to. This is supposed to make some people happy that they're not saying that there isn't a God. But that's generally what they believe. Really, in my opinion, that's what it is. So, this word here, anybody know who coined it? I'll just throw out a trivia question. I'm not expecting anybody maybe to know. Anybody know who coined this word? Anybody, by chance? I'll say his name, you probably still won't even recognize him probably. It was a person by the name of Thomas Huxley. And that was, I even wrote down in 1870, he first used this in a speech. And he really even bragged about later on about how he came up with this belief system. And he did not consider this a belief system. He considered it a method. It's a scientific, an intellectual scientific principle is what he referred to it as. And he always had this quote that he kind of said along with it to describe what agnosticism was. It says, And listen to this. This is something. Do not pretend conclusions are certain that cannot be demonstrated. Do not pretend that conclusions are certain if they cannot be demonstrated. That's what his idea is. So, you know, don't pretend there's a God, or don't pretend that all these miracles happen if you can't prove scientifically that they were demonstrated. Now, who is Thomas Huxley? We're going to talk more about him. He is who I call, and this is my coinage, because he gets to make up words. I can too, I guess. He is the devil behind Darwin. That's who Thomas Huxley was. In fact, I'm not even convinced that Darwin's Origin of the Species would have been even published if it wasn't for him goading him into doing it. And I have some more quotes from Thomas Huxley later. But how ironic is that? I mean, you guys know something about evolution, right? How well does "do not pretend conclusions are certain that cannot be demonstrated" fit in with that? Okay, and so this is this. And what I'm trying to do here, I always try to just tell you what I'm trying to do in case I never do it right. We're going to go into evolution. We need to understand the basis of where this came from. It's very important for me. That's my main goal this week, for you to really understand how this evolved. Okay? It's very important that we see this. Okay? So, there's really always been, in the opinion of man, two ways to find truth. There's religion, and there's, it used to be philosophy, but that kind of just turns into science. Religion or science, which one are you going to choose to find your truth? And we tried to already establish the fact that only one of them gives the absolute truth. The other one gives relative truth to a frame of reference of our creation that we're in. And we can find some interesting things, some interesting relative truths about the natural laws that God has put into place in our world. I enjoy looking at that. But I enjoy looking at that because I'm continuously amazed every time I learn something new about how powerful God is. That's how we need to look at science. And science is cool. It is. Okay? You should enjoy it. It can be very, very interesting, but you need to enjoy it so that it shows what the power of God is. And this has always been a choice. It's always been a choice. There's always been science to search for your truth, or there's been knowledge, or human knowledge, human wisdom, or there's God's way. These are the two choices. These were the two original choices, weren't they? You had the tree of life, the tree of God, the tree of absolute truth, eternal life, and you have the tree of what? Gnosis. You have the tree of science. That's what we had right there, the tree of science. And the tree of science can sometimes look very appealing. It can look very appealing, and we eat of that tree. But what were the fruits? The fruit of one of those trees, the fruit of absolute truth, is life. What's the fruit of the other one? It only gives you death. And so when we have certain branches of science, like the one we're going to be talking about, that produces evil and it produces death. This is what it does. When I look at the word gnosis, do we have any Star Wars fans in here? So I'm going to really show my nerdiness. You a Star Wars fan? Okay. I'll ask you some trivia questions. Remember in episode 2? This will be annoying to some people too. I'm sorry. I just can't. Every time I see gnosis, I just think about this. Episode 2, the Clone Wars. Remember the big battle on the planet? Anybody know what that planet was called? Geonosis, right? Geonosis. Yeah, the planet of knowledge. We put an EO on the geo. Yeah. Okay, here's another question. These things come to me and I shouldn't go with them. I know I shouldn't. Sith Lords. How many Sith Lords can there be at any given time? Two. That's awesome. I got a whole bunch of friends in here. Two. Okay, now do you know why? Sith Lords are the Dark Lords, you know, like Darth Vader and Darth Maul and Darth Sidious and all the, I can name a whole bunch more of it. Do you know why there's only could only be two? The Master and Apprentice, you can only have two, the Master and the Apprentice, but how come only two? There's a lot of religious implications for Star Wars. You should really study it. It's evil, right? It's evil. It's evil, and you can't have more than two because what happens? They start killing each other. It's evil. They can't have two masters. Oh, that'd be a problem. You know, and they can only have one master, one apprentice. You can only have two because they will start killing each other, and eventually they're supposed to do that anyway. The apprentice is supposed to kill the master, take his place, and have a new apprentice. That was the... If you read... I probably shouldn't have done all that. But anyway, I think that's interesting. That's what happens with evil. That's what happens with evil. They can only have two. And of course, we know you can't be a servant of what? You can't be a servant of two masters. Either you will love the one and hate the other. Right? And when we read that verse, it says, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. And we're going to talk about a lot of people that really hold to their master in despite of the evidence, the overwhelming evidence, that they should be following the other master. This is very important when we look at this process of evolution. Today we're going to kind of talk about the precursor. There's a major precursor for evolution, how this started, came about, called the principle of uniformitarianism. And we're going to look at that, and then we're going to see how it's applied to two things, geologic column and carbon dating. See, I told you. I told them all I was talking about dating. That's why they're all on the front row. Oh, gotcha. Okay, so we want to talk about the principle of uniformitarianism and how it applies to these two things. And we'll try to do that pretty quickly. So I want to take you, to begin with, to what I believe is one of the most interesting prophecies in the New Testament. And so, and this is, everything's going to be centered around this particular passage. So I'm going to put it up here, but you might want to go to it too and kind of just examine it. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 through 6. I am extremely intrigued whenever I read this passage and think about how true this prophecy came to be fulfilled in really the last 230 years. In my opinion, I really, and you might have other ideas of what this might be talking about, but, and you can try to convince me, but I'm not sure you have much luck. When I read this, I just think, oh, yep, that happened. That totally happened. First of all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming, he promised. Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. Everything just keeps going on in a normal kind of a process. But they deliberately forget. See that? It's not just they forget. They deliberately forget. They forget on purpose. How do you forget on purpose? They deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water. Okay, so what's that? That's creation. They deliberately forget about two things. Peter says, this is real specific. Two things that they deliberately forget about. Creation, and by these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. The flood. Okay? People are going to come. They're going to say things have always continued in a certain manner, always from the very, very beginning. They've always continued in that way. And Peter says they deliberately forget about two major things. That means that that's not true. The creation and the flood. That is incredibly significant. That is a very important prophecy. Up until about the 18th century, okay, scientists were in pretty much complete agreement because the evidence, the geologic evidence, was overwhelming. I mean overwhelming. What has happened to our Earth in the past? We weren't there, so what has happened? There was a massive, 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 I can't say massive enough, flood on the Earth. And everybody understood this. Scientists understood this because they said, look at this. Look at this huge mess of what's happened here. There was a huge flood. Everybody believed it. It's called catastrophism. The fact that we could have catastrophic events that would occur that could really, really change some things in the Earth. And everybody believed this. And of course, one of the reasons they believed it is because there's written accounts. Right? There's a written account of it. Have you ever read that written account? Okay, it's in the Bible, but that's not even the only one. Now, that should be enough. That should be enough for us. But every society has written accounts of a massive worldwide flood. They all do. You can see actually even drawings, pictures of different boats, different arcs on what they look like. There's the Chinese boat. And these, of course, that would make sense because we started after the flood. What did we have? How many people did we have? We had 8 people. You don't think that story was going to be passed down? I'd be passing that story. That'd be quite a story to be able to tell. Some of the stories I tell my kids are way more boring than that, I think are neat. Okay, this story is going to go down through all different nations. And as the Tower of Babel, we're going to be spread out. And this story is going to continue on. And it would be no surprise at all to find all these stories in all these different civilizations. So there's written record. There was overwhelming scientific proof that this was the case. And so that's what it was. And no one really even questioned that. And if we look at it, I did put a definition here of catastrophism. The distant, because I don't completely agree with this, but the distant past consisted of epochs of paroxysmal and catastrophic action interposed between periods of comparative tranquility. These periodic catastrophes have significant showing in the stratigraphical record. Now, to me, there was probably just one really big one, but this is really coming back because people have realized we can't deny it. I mean, we're stupid for denying it. And so this has really been making a big progress back, and this is the way they define it because they still don't want to believe in creation. So we talk about that every once in a while, you know, we can have these really big things that really change things up and to make it look like things are older than maybe they are, but they're still not going to, you know, adhere to the fact of what the Bible says. You know, it was about a little over 1,600 years, you know, a little over 1,600 years that there was an earth that existed, quite a few people by that time, animals, and it was wiped out. Does everybody understand that there was an old earth that we don't really know a whole lot about? There was an old earth. Right now we're on the middle earth. There's some Lord of the Rings things too. And apparently there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth in the future. What that's going to be like, I can't really tell you. But I didn't. As I was telling Charles, I recently debated a Jehovah's Witness about that, but never mind. Okay. So, a little over 1,600 years after creation, we have this major flood. The Bible records this worldwide flood. And in my opinion, there is no greater scientific evidence If you want to have scientific evidence, if you need scientific evidence to bolster your faith, which I hope you do not, but if you need it, that's the one. There is no greater scientific evidence, the proof of the Bible. That's all we have, is a huge record of, wow, what happened here? A worldwide flood. We have a globe that looks like it's one of those that was just shaken up. Just shaken up, and everything filtered out according to exactly how you would think in science, physics. We could prove how things would filter out, and it would look exactly like that. And it'd look exactly like that. And we have down at the bottom, we have, you know, rock with no life in it. And then we have life, and it's all dead, and upside down, and all over here. And we have trees, fossilized trees that are going clear across multiple layers, millions of years. That's an amazing tree. Especially since it's upside down. It's upside down. What's up with that? You know, and what we're going to do, we're going to invent something to try to explain all of that. When it's such an easy explanation. God's told us what the explanation is. So, during the 1600s, the Age of Reason, and then we get into the 1700s with the revolutions, and we get into the Age of Enlightenment, and then we come even down in our time of the Age of Modernism. There was a huge, really what it was a rejection of the apostate church, is really what it was. The devil's original strategy was starting to wane. You think he just goes away when his strategies start to wane? Because he's not God. His strategies eventually kind of don't work anymore. What does he do? He just goes on. Don't ever think he's just resting. He is always coming after you. And so, because the apostate church was kind of being rejected, and therefore even God was being rejected, the Bible was being rejected, but all the scientific world said catastrophism, you know, that there was a huge flood. Something needed to be done about that. We cannot have there be a big flood. Do you know why we can't have there be a big flood? Because the Bible says there was. And people say that the Bible is inspired by God. And Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And does Jesus refer to the flood? Yes, he does. And so the fact that there's a flood means that we have to believe in this. If there's a flood, we have to believe in this. And so scientists, some people, because they were angry, and some of them had a right to be angry, you know, some of their friends were burned at the stake. Right? This is what happens. The devil works through this. They tried to come up with something new. Anything to reject this possibility. And that's what it comes down to. That's what it was. That's how we start to get this. It comes in because we need to come up with some other idea, any kind of idea, so that we do not have this global flood that the Bible says happened. We need to deliberately forget about it. That's what we have to do. We got to deliberately forget about it and come up with something new. So, in 1785, we have the atheist James Hutton, who wrote a book called The Theory of the Earth. He's known as the father of geology. 1785. And in there, he had a phrase that really stuck with a lot of people. He said, "The present is the key to the past. Things, the way they're going now, are the way they've always been going." Did you hear about that before? Peter told us that, didn't he? He said people would arise that would say this. He said, you can find this in textbooks. This phrase will be in textbooks. The present is the key to the past. If the Colorado River is slowly eroding down through, and I measure that it eroded down 2 centimeters in the last 100 years or whatever. I didn't even look it up. I think it's so ridiculous. Then I'll extrapolate that back because it's always done that exact same thing. Always. It's always done that. And I'll go back and I'll say, whoa, it took, you know, millions and millions of years to erode this out. And so this principle a lot of times is called gradualism too, because they said if we go by the principles of today, then we can make the earth be really, really old. And that's good, because all these religious people are saying it's like 6,000 years old or so. So let's try to figure out how we can make it be really, really long. And so this was a great theory to put forth to convince, at first, all of his atheist friends. That's where it started. But eventually, you know, people thought, well, these are scientists, so I'm not going to argue with them. And people in the church just started, well, you know, maybe it's possible. And we could go and we start rejecting what God has told us. So here's the way it goes. So we have, after James Hutton, we have Charles Lyell in 1830. It's like, this is 50 years later. And the reason it's 50 years later is because, you know, the idea that the there was a flood that occurred from the evidence is pretty overwhelming. And so this didn't really take on that good at the beginning, because it's like, you know, I mean, come on, look at this. I mean, clearly there's been a flood here. I mean, there's things on the mountains that shouldn't be up there. You know, there's overwhelming evidence. So in 1830, Charles Lyell wrote The Principles of Geology, and he took the present as the key to the past, and he knew the value of this. He's an atheist. He knew the value of this and what this could do, how this could really help to deliberately forget about the creation and about the flood. And so he wrote The Principles of Geology. Why is that important? Because this book right here, Principles of Geology, became the Bible for a man by the name of Charles Darwin. He carried this book everywhere he went. And in 1859, he wrote, by the much influence of Thomas Huxley, which we'll talk about a little bit, 1859, on the origin, and some of you might not know this, you know, we always talk about the name of the book was The Origin of Species, right? Well, no books back there had a short name as short as that. They had these really long names. The name of Charles Darwin's book, later on it was shortened to The Origin of Species because people realized that what he was saying could be offensive to some people. The name of the book is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. You see that title? I hope we have some problems with that. So, Charles Lyell, when he wrote his book, there's a lot of other letters that go along with these books, personal correspondence between people you can read. And it's just, it's vain. It's just vain. The whole thing is vain. That goes back to Peter too, right? Vain babblings. They're vain about what they, you know, we're going to change the world, literally. We're going to change the world, and we're going to make this up, and we're going to do this. And Charles Lyell, in one of his private letters, was bragged about, I write better science than Moses. I write better science than Moses. It's evil. It's evil. That's what it is. The devil, I believe, has really worked with these people and put these ideas forward. So Charles Darwin kept going with the principle of uniformitarianism, and he said, okay, so we evolve, we change, we can over time, and however fast we're evolving right now. You know, according to the principle of uniformitarianism, means how fast we've always been evolving. Well, how fast are you evolving right now? Pretty slow, right? So we have to take that time, and then we can extrapolate backwards, and we can say it's as old as we want, really. And we can make up whatever we want how old the Earth is. And so for evolution to take place, and mathematically, by the way, in physics, we like math. Mathematically, we can show that technically it's impossible, that it's improbable. But it doesn't matter, because the people generally, you know, a lot of people just accept things. Just accept it, you know, and don't even think about it. And if I put a million years on it, like, whoa, well, maybe in a million years anything's possible. Right? Well, then, you know, a lot of math people came out and said, hey, there's no way in a million years it could be. And so what do they do? A billion years. Do we understand these numbers? Does our government understand these numbers? I mean, really? You know, I mean, how many congressmen have you said that, oh, this is this many million or this many billion, and they meant trillion? They don't even know. They don't even know what these numbers mean. These numbers are huge, and they don't make any sense. And if we just put a huge number on it, then, you know, anything's possible in that amount of time, isn't it? Anything can be possible. And we can even still show that, you know, you put a billion years on it, it's still not probable. It's just not mathematically probable for things to come into place. So, the principle of uniformitarianism. So this is the thing. This is This is what this whole thing's about right here. This is the main thing. This is what you're writing down and remembering today if you forget everything else. The fundamental principle of doctrine that processes and natural laws now operating in the universe and on Earth have acted in the same regular manner and with essentially the same intensity throughout time. And that past history can be explained by phenomena and forces observable today. That's the principle of uniformitarianism. We like to use really big words to keep you confused. That's our job in science. The principle of uniformitarianism. Everything is uniform. Okay? So if I see you arriving to the two-week meeting and I know that you came from somewhere that was 200 miles away and I see you pulling in and you're going 50 miles per hour, according to the principle of uniformitarianism, I can figure out a time, how long it took you. It would have taken you 4 hours. Right? 200 miles away, and I see you approaching. The present day experience that I have is that you are coming in at 50 miles per hour. I can do the math on that pretty easy. Apply the principle of uniformitarianism. Say you've always done that rate the entire time. Right? How many of you have kids? Okay? Point taken by some people. So 4 hours, that's how long it would be. Okay? This is the principle of uniformitarianism. And Peter in his prophecy said there are two things that violates this that you are deliberately leaving out. You are deliberately forgetting. There was a creation, so we don't have things just evolving all the way out. We have a start of stuff, so you can't extrapolate backwards with evolution. There is a creation. You're forgetting about that. And you're forgetting about a worldwide flood where things in the old world could have been, in my opinion, were really different than things that we have in this corrupted, decaying world now. Now, in Genesis, we do have kind of a principle. You know, and I'm not saying this thing's totally bad. We do have kind of a principle of uniformitarianism that's mentioned in Genesis 8. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. That's kind of a principle of uniformitarianism, isn't it? That things are going to kind of keep going the way that is. Now, when was this said? Right after the flood. Okay? So, that's fine. You know, we have to kind of understand that a little bit. If I drop a rock, it goes down to the ground. It's kind of a gravitational law, and I think I'm safe to assume that that's probably. But you know, if all of a sudden that didn't happen, that would be confusing, really confusing. So we kind of assume that some of these laws that we have that are in this frame of reference paradigm that God has created for us are always going to occur and be that way. So, but the problem is that this is after the flood, and evolutionists do not consider the flood. Found another quote by Stephen Gould. Everybody heard of Stephen Gould? There's many famous evolutionists. The famous American evolutionist was Stephen Jay Gould, and he is now dead and understands everything. But at this time, he wrote this. In essence, really listen to these words. In essence, the constancy of natural laws must be assumed in our study of the past. Because if we do not, then we cannot meaningfully study the past. Making inferences about the past is wrapped up in the difference between studying the observable present and the unobservable past. In the observable present, induction can be regarded as self-corrective. That is to say, our erroneous beliefs about the observable world can be proven wrong and corrected by other observations. Observations, right? This is Popper's principle of falsifiability. However, past processes are not observable by their very nature. Therefore, in order to come to conclusions, that doesn't say the right conclusions, whatever conclusions you want, about the past, we must assume the invariance of natural laws. So it's just an admission. We can't observe anything. So we have to just assume the principle of uniformitarianism, that things go on, have always gone on that same way. But that's going to lead us to the conclusion then that the earth is extremely, extremely old, which is exactly what they want to do. The principle of uniformitarianism is the backbone of all old Earth philosophies, such as evolution. It's all based on this original principle that started. Two major things that I just kind of, there's a whole bunch of different things, but two of them that I think we just kind of go over with today is like the rate of sedimentation with the geologic column. This is, we assume that things have always just kind of been put down layer after layer, a very slow process for a long time. And that refers to the geologic column. And then the other thing is dating fossils and dating rocks. That is based also on the principle of uniformitarianism. And so I want to look at both of those real quick. Here we have the geologic column. You can Google the geologic column. You get all kinds of pictures. I just chose this one because it had some pretty pictures and it was nicely colored. But all of them are not real. They're not. You don't see a real picture of them. In fact, these don't even actually exist. They only exist in your textbook. You can find them in all kinds of textbooks, but they only exist in the textbook. They don't exist in nature all at once. Now, there's different layers here, and there's layers here, and sometimes the layers that are here somewhere else in the world are like up here, and some of them are actually going straight up. Some of them are horizontal even. And some of them are completely missing altogether. And then some places we have certain layers that you can't find anywhere else. And so, of course, they slide that in there, too. I heard sometime that if we actually put every single layer that's supposed to be in the geologic column, it'd be like 150 miles deep or something like that. So this column is made up based on how we think over time we have these sedimentation. From 1900, this is after Darwin here, from 1900 to 1950, the Earth aged from 20 million years old to the current 4.6 billion years old. I think it has something to do with relativity of time or something. I'm not sure. 20 million to 4.6 billion. And why did it change? Because it had to. It had to. They needed to make it older and older and older. They started off at a certain day and they thought, well, there's no way that we could have this happen in this amount of time. So they have to keep adding on. I don't know how much older it's going to get, but they just have to keep on adding on these times. From 1990 to 1994, the satellite Magellan flew by Venus and with radar, it mapped out Venus and it discovered something really quite amazing to the people, that everything looked kind of the same and it all had like the same age, and it was a fairly recent age, and that was really mind-boggling to the scientists. So what they said was that there was a big headline: Venus is missing like 90% of its history. You know how it happened? They don't either. But they said some unforeseen cataclysmic event is what happened. Now, why can't we just say it looks young? It's probably young. Doesn't that seem like to be the most simplest scientific principle? But no, we say it's 90% of its history is gone. Now, why do we do that? Because we have a belief that we have to fit the evidence into. We don't come up with a belief because we see the evidence. We have to fit this belief into the evidence fit the evidence into this belief that we already have. You ever heard that, I'll believe it when I see it? I mean, that's what we normally say, isn't it? I'll believe it when I see it. That's actually a good scientific principle. I'll believe when I... Now, it wasn't a good principle for Thomas. It's not probably a really good spiritual principle, but it is for science. I'll believe it when I see it. Well, they change it around, don't they? They'll say, I'll see it because I believe it. Right, and so whenever I get some evidence, I think, okay, I'm going to fit it in there. And a lot of times the fit is really bad, but they'll fit it in there. It doesn't matter what we come up with, they'll fit it in there. This is what we'll battle forever. It doesn't matter what overwhelming evidence that we could even find in the future. I don't think there's anything we could do. A lot of times we talk about, what about a miracle? Well, what was said about miracles? They wouldn't even believe miracles. And they wouldn't believe any kind of evidence that we could probably throw at them. So, and a lot of times we look at the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon actually has more layers than any other place. And so a lot of people always refer to the Grand Canyon. But the problem is, Grand Canyon has a lot of problems. And there's lava flows up on top that they have dated. And there's problems with their dating too, so they could even be off on that. I'm surprised they haven't just said that's what they're off on. But that's way older than lava flows that they have down at the bottom. And there's all kinds of problems with their dating methods too. What does the fossil record say? What does the fossil record say? Well, the fact that there are fossils says a lot. You know, people just, I don't think, just they try to keep people in the dark on this. You know, how are fossils formed? You hit a deer on the side of the road in Iowa, it could happen to you today. You know, is that deer going to become a fossil? No. It's going to get eaten, or it's going to decay, it's going to rot away. Fossils get formed by being covered immediately and in the presence of water. That's how all fossils are formed that way. This is the way they are formed. And so the fact that we have this mass graveyard of fossils says that they had to be covered quickly with a lot of water. So the fact that we have the fossils at all is quite amazing. Genesis 3:19 says, "For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and to dust shalt thou return." This is what fossils are. Fossils aren't living. There's no living matter left in fossils. Water has run through it, and it's mineralized, and it's stone. Fossils are rock, is what they are, eventually. I got this picture here. We talked about the polystrate or the polystratic trees. This was a picture of a fossilized tree. And this is the tree that there was. It was upside down, and it covers millions of years of time, apparently. It covers all these layers of rock. Well, this is what you would expect, I think, in a worldwide flood. 95% of all the fossils are marine invertebrates like shellfish and clams. So 95% of all of these fossils that we have are shellfish and clams. 4.75% are algae and plant fossils. So now we're pretty much got it all, right? Do the math on that one. That's a lot easier than the square root of 0.7. 0.2375% are insects and other invertebrates. 0.0125% are vertebrates, fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals, dinosaurs. And 1% of that last percentage consists of more than a single bone. That's a real problem. There's a real deception out there when you take one little tiny chunk of a bone and they make an entire model out of it and put it in museums, and kids go through and think, wow, look at that they found. Well, they found that little bone right there that's the white part. Everything else is all clay-type models. It's a real delusion. And the problem is with this is there's major circular reasoning on this, because they have these things called index fossils, which they think evolved and was only around a certain period of time. And so if you take a rock to them, they'll try to date it with some method. But then if you say, well, I found this fossil in it, well, then, okay, then that's not right, and it's this old, because we have index fossils that are based on ages, based on our evolutionary thought. That's what it's based on. So we have certain times we associate with certain fossils. So it doesn't matter that I just dated this rock to be a certain age. Now that you tell me there was a fossil embedded in that rock, I'm going to use that date to date the rock that it was in. But you just said you were going to date the rock so I can figure out what the date of my fossil was. Now you're dating the fossil to tell me what the date of the rock is. There's a problem with that in science. We have a real problem with that in science. That kind of reasoning shouldn't be allowed. And this is the way they do this. Why do we have this geologic call? Why do we have this? You know, and it all comes down to is depending on what is your belief. What is your belief? Do you believe in an evolutionary process where we have layers being put down over millions and millions of years, and we have these different fossils, and the way this looks is that, you know, you have only these fossils right here. Well, you don't. You have these fossils in a lot of those different things. But primarily, most of those type of fossils are lower. So are we going to look at this and we're going to say that these evolved into these and these evolved into these over time, and eventually we got up to the woolly mammoth and the dinosaurs and things like this, and that we have this evolution process? Or are we going to look at this in a completely different frame of reference, the way they used to look at it, and say, you know, this is what you would see
if there was a huge flood on the earth, where we have rock clear down here that doesn't have any life in it at all, and then all of a sudden we have layers of sediment on top of there, that all of a sudden have life. In science, they call it the Cambrian explosion. They have terms for it because they can't deny it. All of a sudden, there's life. It's right there. So, that would make sense if you believe in a creation. All of a sudden, you have life. And then what do you have? You have a whole bunch of fossils that are deposited exactly in the order you would expect if you had a worldwide flood. Wouldn't you expect clams and sea creatures and things to be, a lot more of them, to be down at the bottom? You know, and then what do you have next? Well, you can have eventually some amphibians. Where do they exist? They exist land, water. That's where they are. That's their zone. That's their environment. Then you have reptiles a little bit more up on the land. And they're a little bit more agile. They can run. And they were running. We can have animals and humans and dinosaurs and all these creatures. And I'd really like to see some of those creatures that were on that ark. I'll tell you right now. You know, I don't know. That old world was something a little bit different. It was something a little bit different, and it'd be interesting to see what was exactly on there. And they would, of course, be probably running up the mountain, right? try to find drier ground. And so we have layers where we'd expect these things to be. So we have some scriptures that we need to look at here. Exodus 20, verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. And in several passages in the New Testament, we have Jesus subtly referring to these. But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. From the beginning of the creation, in Mark 10:6, the blood of all the prophets which was shed from the foundation of the world. Jesus acknowledges that this happened. So we want to try to reject this so we can reject Jesus, is what evolutionists would like to do. Matthew 24:37-39. But as the days of Noah were, this is what Jesus said. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving to marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. And that's what Jesus said. So if we're going to reject the flood, then we're rejecting Christ. We're going to reject His resurrection. We're going to reject your salvation, is what we're going to do. If we're going to say that this is all of evolution, this geologic column, it's not just the ending of the flood, then that's what we're doing, we're rejecting. And this is a lie. This is a lie that has been sent forth, and it's been sent forth by the devil. What is the devil? What's he known for? When he lies, he speaks his native language. That's what he's always done. That's what he will always do. He is a liar. He is the father of lies, and he will put these lies out for us to see. Here's your statement you can write down to understand anything I said. The geologic column does not show what evolved first. It just shows what was buried first. It's exactly what we would predict. Exactly, scientifically, what we would predict on how we would see all this. It's a mass graveyard. Is all it is a mass graveyard laid down exactly the way we would predict it to be laid down. A lot of chaos in there. A lot of churning up of various things. Let's just look real quickly at this account. Genesis 7:11-19. I really don't think we, even as Christians, quite understand this flood event sometimes. I think it's, I mean, this is a momentous event. And if you read it, it sounds, I mean, just read it. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, that same day, were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. It's kind of confusing. I'm not really sure exactly what that is. There's a lot of theories out there. I'm not going to go into a lot of the theories about there being a water shell and the water opening, but wherever God provided the water and the fountains of the great deep broken up, I think I kind of understand that. That makes a lot of sense. That's, to me, is volcanic eruption. And we have overwhelming scientific evidence on that. We have an element called iridium that we find in all these different layers, and that's why they think that there was, they're starting to think that there was a flood, but it came because of the big asteroid that hit the Gulf of Mexico that caused the big flood. And the reason they think that, they're willing to do that because that's not in the Bible. So that's the reason to go ahead and have a big catastrophe as long as it's not mentioned in the Bible. And we find iridium, the element iridium, in meteorites. So that would explain it. But we find iridium way more in volcanoes. So when we have this big fountains of the Great Deep breaking up, and like 90% of all volcanic eruptions is water anyway, so we have this major upheaval, land going up, land going down. We can, if we take the whole Earth and we flatten it back out, we can easily, mathematically, we can easily show that we can take all the mountains and throw them into the sea. And we can't do that, unless we have great faith, apparently. But we can do that. They'll fit into the oceans easy. People always ask, well, where'd all the water go afterwards? Well, it's still here. It's in the oceans. It's very simple. We could take all the mountains and we could put them in the oceans. In fact, we flattened everything out. We figured out mathematically that we could probably have water up to a depth of 9,000 feet around the entire world. So, people say, well, Mount Everest is 29,000 feet. Well, it wasn't back then. It was something less. And it got built. God can move mountains. You believe that? Pretty easily. He can do that. And it went up. That's why we find clams at the top of Mount Everest. I mean, there's evidence right there that it was upheaval and valleys down. And we can go to Psalms 104 and read all about that. If you want to go to Psalms 104, tell you exactly that's what he did. So you can do that, because I'm going to skip all that, I think. Okay. All right, let's, we got 10 minutes. There's a lot of things that I skip, and I'm going to try to maybe come back to some of those things on Friday and review some of those things. So if you have some other questions about some of those things, then you can pass them along and I'll try to get to them. Let's talk some chemistry, right? I told Lindsay that I was going to talk about dating. She goes, what's that have to do with science? And she goes, oh, chemistry. That was pretty good. That was pretty good. And ironically, I am going to talk about chemistry. So I don't know how many of this is where some people might start tuning out on me, but we have these models of atoms, and this is not, these are not really good models anymore. We know a lot more stuff about it, so this isn't really kind of how we think they really are too much. But we have in the center of atoms, we have what we call the nucleus. And it's not like the nucleus of a cell where it's just holding some things together. We have just particles that are the nucleus. And what are the things in the nucleus? Protons and neutrons, right? Protons and neutrons. What are the charge on protons? P, protons, positive. And neutrons, neutrons are what? Neutral, right? And so they're all together there. And opposite, like charges would repel. So why that nucleus is staying together, we're not really sure. There's a really strong force that's keeping it together. I don't know what that is. So around the nucleus, we have electrons, and they have negative charge, right? So an atom overall is neutral because the electrons and the protons balance each other out, and the neutrons don't have any charge anyway. So we have these neutral atoms. And elements are dependent on how many protons they have. That's what defines what an element is. So if an element has 7 protons, I don't care how many electrons or neutrons you tell me it has, it's going to be nitrogen if it has 7 protons. If it has 6 protons, it is what? It is carbon. So this has the protons and neutrons, the things in the center, are the only things that really have mass. The electrons don't really have any mass. So the whole entire mass of the atom is based on adding up all your protons and your neutrons. So if I have an atom of carbon, I have 6 protons and I have 6 neutrons, the total mass of this atom is 12. And so we call it carbon 12. 12 is the mass of that atom in some obscure mass units, which I won't talk about. So over here, we can have another variety of carbon. We call them isotopes. You guys heard that? Isotopes? Okay? So we have 6 protons, so it's what element? It's carbon. If it has 6 protons, it's carbon, always. But this one has 8 neutrons in it, so this is carbon mass of 14, right? 6 plus 8 is 14. So we have carbon 14, we have carbon 12. And these are out of nature in kind of various forms. We have a lot more carbon-12 than we do carbon-14. Carbon-14 is kind of radioactive. It's unstable. It'll eventually break down into nitrogen-14. So if you look on a periodic table, we have all these different elements, and here's carbon right here. And right there, so at the top, you see the atomic number. It's a 6. That means how many protons it has. This is ordered by the atomic number. And then down below carbon right there, you'll see a number, and that's called the atomic mass. And you'll see that it's 12.01 something. And the reason for that is what we just said, carbon's either 12 or it's 14, right? Well, that's an average mass. So if I take any sample of carbon, and you had to pull an atom of carbon out, which one would you guess you're pulling out? If the average mass is 12.01? 12, right? There's not much odds of pulling out a carbon-14 atom if the average is that close to 12. If the average is 13, then it'd be 50-50 chance of pulling out a carbon-14 or carbon-12, right? So that's what, I don't know if anybody wanted to know that, but that's the atomic masses on there is the average masses of all the different kinds of that particular element. Okay? I'd spend a lot more time with that in class if we were doing that. So anyway, we want to talk about dating processes, carbon dating in particular. There's several different dating processes. There's potassium-argon dating. These are two elements. There's argons over there, potassium right there. Uranium and lead, which is somewhere there's lead, and uranium should be right there. And then rubidium and strontium, those two right there. These all three here are dating process on how one of those elements, how long it takes for it to decompose into the other element over time. And those take really, really long times. And we use those to date rocks. Okay? Date rocks. We're talking about carbon dating, which is what you hear of most of the time, right? Carbon dating. Okay? We don't date rocks with carbon dating. Scientists know that. You can't date rocks with carbon dating. We date them with, it has carbon in it. So it has to have been a living type of a thing. Which means we don't date almost all the fossils because they're actually already rock. They don't have any carbon at all or any organic nature left to them at all. So we're talking about radiocarbon dating today because there's certain problems with it, and the problems are the same with these other ones, so I'm not going to talk about all of them. We're just talking about quickly here radiocarbon dating. And we'll skip all that. And let's go to the parable of the Vandalia meatballs. Here's going to be the problem with carbon dating. Okay? Let's assume that I came in last week and I saw Charles Engel making meatballs. And I want to know, I wonder how long he's been making those meatballs. So I would do a little scientific experiment. I'd just watch him for a while. Right? The present. I'm in the present. That's all I can observe. I'd watch him for a little while and see how many meatballs he's making. He makes 3 meatballs per second. He's pretty good at it. Okay? And so I could go over there and see how many meatballs he's made throughout the week. And then I could apply the principle of uniformitarianism, couldn't I? And make an estimate on how many how fast Charles Engel can make meatballs. Okay? This is the basis kind of what we do in dating. Now there's some problems with that. I made some assumptions, didn't I? You know, there's a really good possibility that Charles got way better at making meatballs by the time I'd seen him. Okay? Maybe he was a lot slower earlier on. That's gonna really affect the time that I think he's been making meatballs. How many meatballs were already there? You know, I mean, maybe those are the first 3 he made and his wife made all the other ones. Right? I mean, I don't know how many meatballs were already originally there. Were there any meatballs added or taken away? Did someone come and add some more meatballs on his tray, or did someone take them all away? These are all assumptions that I didn't put into my original thought. It sounded like a good idea, but I didn't put those into my original thought. This is the same thing, really, with radiocarbon dating. And we'll go through this real quick. Basically, there's cosmic rays that come from the sun, and they run into these nitrogen-14 atoms. That converts them to carbon-14 atoms. The carbon-14 atoms can get absorbed into the atmosphere and into plants. Most all carbon in the atmosphere is carbon-12, keep in mind. Most all of it's carbon-12. But we get some carbon-14 in there because of this process. And this is true, we do. We get this in there. And then animals can eat the plants. plants can eat the animals, we eat plants. So we get basically what we assume is there's a ratio mixture of carbon-12 to carbon-14 in the environment that is the same throughout us all. Well, what happens when something dies? When something dies, the carbon-14 in the body then goes back into nitrogen-14. It turns back to nitrogen-14. Does that make sense? So what they think they have there is a clock. Right? I can see, you know, I can assume, I can look at the carbon-12 to carbon-14 ratio in our environment today, assume it's always been that way, and then see how much carbon-14, this dead thing, has in it left. And then I can make an assumption backwards on how much time it has been. Okay? There are some problems with that, of course. The same assumptions we did with the Vandalia meatballs. Has the decay rate from carbon-14 to nitrogen-14, has that always been the same? I have the least problem with that one. But it's possible it might not have been the same. But that's my least problem. Has the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 always been constant forever? I got a huge problem with that one. Because I would have to, on purpose, deny the flood and what could have been the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 at that time. So that's a real big problem. Leaching or contamination. Okay, and they all know that there's a lot of problems with different kinds of things come in. Leaching, contamination, we have problems on those. So we have freshly killed seals that are dated at 1,300 years old. We have living snail and clam shells that are dated at 27,000 years old. And they said, well, there's problems with that. After they figure out that's not the right time, they say there's problems with that. And we reject about half of the dates for carbon dating. Well, if we reject half of them, why do we accept the other half? I mean, it's just toss a coin. Why don't you just toss a coin? It's 50% that way too. So we have a lot of problems with the dating methods. A lot of times they used to say that carbon dating could date something up to about 50,000 years. Most people reject that and they say, you know, at the best 3,000 to 4,000 years. And really, if we have some kind of written documentation to go with it, then it's a lot more accurate. But these are the problems with our rocks and other things also. Okay. I'm just going to stop right there and real quickly do my demonstration. Okay. Let's see. You want to get the lights real quick? Thank you. Here we have a fan blade. You can see it's going around really fast. Okay. And a lot of times in physics what we do is we have a strobe light and we can use it to kind of slow things down because I can flash light at it and see where it is at a given moment, and if I can turn to have the light flash off and I have the blade move right around in that exact same spot, when I flash the light again, it'll look like it's right there and like I can freeze it. So I thought I would show you that. Max frequency just perfect. I can make it a little off and I can make it go backwards, or I can stop it and make it go forwards. Okay, but I can freeze it perfectly still, and when I do that, it kind of makes me want to reach out and touch it. I can just reach out, can I just grab that? Can I just grab that? Right? It kind of makes it seem like you can do that. And what would happen if I did that? I would quickly realize that that thing's going around. Okay, you want to hit the lights back on real quick? Well, we'll skip all that. 2 Corinthians 11:13-14. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen masquerading as apostles of light. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. He's Lucifer. He masquerades as light. He illuminates something for you and says, look at this, touch it. And what happens when you do? He gets you. This is exactly what's happened with this theory of evolution. You have your break.